Hello, hello. Welcome back to Brown Games Strong. I am Mitali, and before we go into today's guest episode, I just want to quickly check in. How are you doing? I don't know if you have looked out the window, if you are in the UK, but it is rather doom and gloom outside these days. And a few people I've spoken to have kind of been like, well, we haven't really had a summer this year, have we? And I just think to myself, we did have like 2 weeks of glorious sunshine, but coming from a hot country, I just feel like I'm just never going to be used to the fact that we only get 2 weeks a year and somehow are expected to be grateful for it. So totally valid that we didn't really get a summer, and I feel like we're still kind of waiting for another heat wave or something. But having said that, today is Bank Holiday Monday, and I'm seeing on my Insta stories a lot of people have managed to get out of the country, which I'm super happy for you if you have. So if you have managed to go to Portugal or Spain or Malta or Greece, then I'm really happy for you, but I low-key hate you as well. So I hope you've enjoyed for both of us. Going into today's episode, so I am very, very happy about today's episode because I have another friend on, and this one is really close to my heart because she is Spanish Cindy as well, and I feel like you're going to get a little sneak peek into our brains because we are such a rare breed out here in England. So yeah, it's crazy to me because this guest and I have actually known each other for about 12 years, I want to say, or probably even more than that. And it's just amazing to reminisce and talk about how we used to be back then when we were like 16 and compared to obviously now. I mean, she's doing incredible things and we will go into that shortly. But yeah, it was just reminiscing on like MSN days because, I mean, we are grandmas and we actually had an MSN phase, which a lot of you may not have had, or you might not even know what MSN is. I hope that's not the case. But yeah, it was really, really nice chatting to her, and I'm conscious I haven't actually introduced her. So our next guest's name is Prerna Kimlani, and she is a chartered accountant, and she is also the founder of This Girl Invests, a platform that educates people about investing in personal finance without all of the jargon. I love this topic because I am not very educated in personal finance, to be honest, and I've only very recently got my shit together and making sure that I'm saving every month and that I'm not kind of living in debt and spending more on my credit card than I am, you know, than I can afford and things like that. So speaking to Prerna and having her in my life has been such a blessing because she's given me some invaluable tips that have really helped me just feel more in control of my own finances and my life. And I feel like so many people who don't get that education, especially in the community that we're in, you know, we come from a Sindhi background where I feel like the women are just not really taught about, you know, investing. Like, we're taught to save for sure, but we're not taught financial literacy and how we can actually become wealthy, you know, because we are obviously taught by a generation or advised by a generation that kind of believed more in saving because they, I mean, had different priorities at the time. I kind of entered my 20s feeling very guilty because I blew pretty much all my salary for the first 2 to 3 years. And I feel like this is a very common problem that people have. I don't know if it's a problem because, I mean, I'm not regretting the Novikovs and the Hakkasans that I've had in the past, but I still feel like it's about time that I started getting my life together. I think Prerna has been such a great influence, and I will link all of her content in the description, so her website, which has some incredible blog posts and also some courses that you can look into if you're interested in delving further into learning about your personal finances, and her Instagram. And honestly, there's so much good stuff and it's all digestible. I attended Prerna's Sunday sessions last year, and honestly, I am so glad that this exists. Also, it's so friendly towards women in our community because it really feels like it's a solidarity thing and we're all kind of learning together, and it's just really, really nice. So also, we did record this a while ago. I always feel like I have to make sure I give this disclaimer at the start. If you are listening to this on Apple, then if you could leave a review, I would really appreciate it. It just really helps boost the podcast and allows more people to find out about it. And really, I mean, You know what? I kind of feel like a crazy person talking to you like this because I genuinely feel like I'm just talking at a wall. So I really hope it's going somewhere and I hope that there is someone listening at least somewhere. But yeah, if you have listened to any of the episodes, I would really appreciate it if you dropped a review, if you dropped me a message as well, if you had any really strong burning opinions after any of the episodes. We always appreciate it as creators when we get feedback and we, you know, hear about how you found it. It just reminds us that, you know, there is a reason why we're doing this and keeps propelling us forward. So yeah, that's my rambling over and let's get on with the episode. Hello, Fiona. I'm so, so excited to speak to you today. We've known each other how long now?
Probably since our teens.
Yeah, like 12 MSN years or something. Yeah, MSN days. Good times. I can't even remember what kind of stuff we used to talk about on MSN. I love
the group chat feature where everyone would be like, oh, I'll present you to someone. I'll present you to someone. And we just spent hours online, like literally being online until like 2, 3 a.m. And I was, now looking back, I'm like, what did we do? Like, what were we speaking about for that long?
I had times where I had to like pull my computer plug, like basically switch it off because I could hear my parents coming and they'd be like, why are you still awake? What's wrong?
Honestly, I definitely had those moments of getting a massive telling off when I was awake at the most random times at night. Oh, but those were the days.
But also, where has that time gone? Like, you look back and you think, oh my God, we've gone through university. We both moved to the UK in the same year as well.
Yeah,
so tell me a little bit about your upbringing. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
So my parents are Indian. They moved to Madrid. So my dad got a job in Madrid, so my mum followed when they got married. And we then moved to Lanzarote, the Canary Islands. So yeah, I was brought up there and I'm definitely... Well, at the time I thought, oh, I'm a city girl, you know, I'm done living in the islands, like there's not a lot going on here, and I thought it was too cool. So I was really excited to sort of leave Spain and come to London, which is the same way that you did. But yeah, now looking back years later, now I think, no, I'm definitely an island girl. And I guess it's partly that, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. But I can see the beauty now of being brought up in a small island, which I couldn't see when I was younger.
Do you go back often?
I actually was planning to go twice this year, but then COVID made me cancel both flights. So one was supposed to be just as a family holiday back, and then the other was supposed to be a friend's wedding. So yeah, quite gutted. I definitely go back to Spain at least once a year. Going back to Madrid is usually easier than going back to Lanzarote, but yeah, I definitely try to go back as much as I can.
I don't know if you found this, but when I moved to the UK, I think I got two very common questions. First was, you're Sindhi, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
And the second one was, are there actually Indians in Spain? Is that a thing?
I met this girl at work once that was like, so you basically live where people holiday. I was like, yeah, kind of, but not really. You know, there's loads of Indians that live on the island. But I guess for British people, they just associate being in the Canary Islands as a holiday, not somewhere people actually live. So yeah, I definitely got that too.
And I think they find it really hard to fathom that we go to be at home, like that is home. And yeah, actually it's such a privilege because, I mean, I didn't appreciate it when I was growing up. It seems so normal, yeah, that the sun was out most of the year. I reckon I was like 3 or 4 shades darker just as a, you know, as a standard. It's been weird having lived here now for so long. And I feel like both of our accents have also sort of evolved as we've moved to the UK.
That's like the third question I get when people are like, but you lived in Spain. How do you have the British accent? I'm like, I can't explain. I was like, and then there's always that, when I speak to my mum, my accent changes. It goes like full on Indian. I can't help it. And I know I know I'm not alone. Like, I thought I was a freak when I was young. My cousins would like laugh at me. But it's called mirroring. You like mirror your accent to who you're talking to.
True, because it seems like you're putting it on, but actually thinking about it, like, no. But yeah, so you grew up in the Canary Islands. And what was that like in terms of, you know, embracing your dual identity?
Good question. I think it was always difficult because at home there were certain, you know, there were certain rules, and I had my, you know, Indian community and all the girlfriends. I was very, very lucky to have a really good group of friends that gave me that sense of community, which was really nice. But then in school, it was like a completely different world. My friends thought completely differently. And so there was always that mishmash a bit, you know, of what I do on the weekend when I'm with my friends and what I do during the week when I'm in school, and how we behave around, yeah, the different people and the different ways of living. It was not something I really thought about actively, but now looking back, I can see how there was definitely a separation. I think maybe the moment it first hit me how different the cultures were, I went to a friend's house, and we had just had lunch, and it was lovely. And then the dad got up and started washing the dishes, and I was like, wait, what? And I had never seen anything like that. I was like, you know, the mom's a housewife. Like, I just assumed, you know, that's how it works. And I think having seen that, it really and having caught myself thinking, oh my god, what's, you know, I've never seen that before, what a great guy, you know. Yeah, it sort of set the tone for like that, you know, there is very different cultures. The Indian culture is very different, and there's a different way of living versus some other cultures. So yeah, it was different, but never a negative thing, never something I think they both have their pros and cons.
Yeah, I was just going to say, a man in the kitchen? That's not something
for this. I want a guy exactly like that, thank you, who will wake up, will get up, pick up the dishes afterwards, clean the dishes. I was shocked.
You know, it's funny because I feel like with the times that has changed, and I don't think many women would be completely okay with being like, right, you don't enter the kitchen, that's my territory. Unless, you know, that is something they feel really passionate about. I don't think it would be a norm anymore the way that it was for us seeing our parents growing up. And I was going to ask you, do you think that there is a difference between Indians in Spain and Indians in the UK?
I think there is. I think I'm a bit embarrassed to admit, but when I moved from Spain to London, I just didn't realize there was that many types of Indians. I hadn't been to India that many times, so obviously I must have noticed that there were different kinds, but it just didn't hit me like that there were that many kinds. So in my head, I did like subliminally think, oh, most people are Sindhis, because that's how our community was. It was mainly Sindhis, and everyone's surname ended in Arnie, and there was only a few that didn't. And so being brought up in that environment and then moving to the UK, it was definitely more multicultural within what is India, because India is huge and tons of different religions and cultures within India. But I think what they've done really well in the UK, and maybe it's partly because the government has a strong, you know, England has a strong connection with India. The culture has really stayed. That like you could easily have kept some of the traditions from like years and years and years ago, because your family moved here and stayed in a community in the UK that, you know, everyone around you did the same sort of, you know, traditional routines and that sort of thing. Whereas in Spain, you were almost forced to open up a bit more. And well, I say that, and then as I say that out loud, I think there's definitely, because it was such a small island, I don't know, maybe it's for you, it was different because you were in a city and Barcelona, and it might have been slightly different, but being in a small island, there's not a lot to do. So on the weekend, you hang out with your friends, and you hang out in that same sort of community. So it is fairly easy to keep things as the status quo and not really knowing beyond that. Whereas in the UK, there's a lot, you know, especially in London, there's tons going on. So you will always notice that there, you know, there's more than just your community out there. So yeah, I think there is a difference. I think the UK has a lot more temples and a lot more, you know, big Indian or Asian events, like Diwali's and Trafalgar Square or Baisakhi or things like that, which has given me a lot more exposure than I ever had having lived in Spain.
Yeah, I agree. I was so shocked with the scale. Like, the scale had just increased massively of all of these festivals and celebrations. I got so caught up in it. I remember the first time I went to Diwali on Trafalgar Square. I think we went together. I genuinely think we were there.
Did you dance one year there? I think you danced there one
year. I did. Yeah, 2 years ago I did. But yeah, I think it was in our first year of uni or something, and we all went together because I think we were all just so shocked that this is a thing. And I remember specifically at the start in uni when we used to all hang out, like us Sindhis from Spain, we all felt like, oh my God, we can't go home for Diwali, and just like spending time with each other. But I remember feeling really shocked by just how many brown people there were in London. I was like, is that even possible? And actually, really interestingly, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, but I came to London for the first time for my interview at uni, and I fell completely in love with it because I saw so many cultures and I saw loads of brown people, and I was just like, yes, like, not used to this at all.
Yeah.
So it definitely feels comforting in a way. And then obviously, like, garba is such a big thing here as well, like doing garba in uni and getting involved in bhangra, and like, there's so many, it's just so rich, right? I completely echo that sentiment of, you know, it's just, everything's just more vast and you learn so much more about your own culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you ever feel, in when you were growing up in school, did you have many other South Asians around you?
So actually, I was really lucky. I had, at any one point, at least one or two friends from the Indian community that were also in my class. And that was really nice. It was really nice that I was not the only one. But then, you know, at the same time, within that class, we both had our own group of friends. And like, so it was nice that, you know, that there was, it didn't make me feel like I stood out, basically. Over the years, there were more and more Asians in the school, and it was quite a small island, so everyone sort of knew each other. And actually, I think that's one of the amazing things, and I don't know what it was, but something about the culture in that school never felt different at all. Like, even from there was, you know, even though there was like people from all sort of income levels and all sorts of, you know, religions and things, I was never made to feel that I was different. And I guess, I think subliminally I would have known it, like there was always like the off comment, like on like skin color or like something, you know, something like that, like what you deem like a microaggression these days. But it was never so strong that it made me uncomfortable or question my position there. Yeah, I don't know if you had a different experience.
That's so nice to hear, actually. Mine was slightly different, I'd say. I definitely internalized a lot of those feelings of feeling different, and it was those microaggressions. But I think I, as a person, I'm also quite hypersensitive to other people and the way that they're behaving around me. But overall, and towards the end of it, I think the experience became more positive as I started kind of stepping into my own identity and body and just feeling comfortable with it and also feeling accepted for it, which only happened once people started maturing. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, but that happens a lot, right? I think kids are just mean. They can be. They just have no filter.
Yeah, it is a traumatic experience no matter who you are or how you grow up, really. Either you're the bully or you're one of the sheep who just sits in the background, or you're actually the victim. So there's always going to be some sort of weird memories from that. But then when you went into university, how did you feel, you know, being immersed in such a different environment that was so culturally diverse?
I loved it. I think moving from a small island, and routine was pretty much set. I think when you're doing your GCSEs, A-levels, every day starts to feel the same because, you know, the end goal is sort of getting to university. And that's all you can think about, right? And then it's like, oh, after that, well, you worry about that later, right? But first, just get into uni. So having that off my back and the pressure off and really to just be at university was great. And I think I had a really strong support system in that my brother had moved to the UK before I did. So, and my cousins, like some of my cousins were here as well. So it didn't feel like I was thrown completely on the deep end. And I think having that really helped. And in terms of culture and like the different, you know, people that I met in uni, I found that really interesting. I found that it really opened my mind up very much to understand, you know, the different ways that people live. So I have very, very fond memories of it. I'm sure there were days where it was just tough and, you know, I think in the first year it was all very exciting. I think the first time you experience anything, it always feels, you know, you feel light and everything's great. And then as you experience it the second time round, it feels heavier. And I think that's when it really hit me. My second year really was just tough. It hit me that it got really dark really soon. It hit me that I had to commute into uni. I was juggling a job and having to study. So yeah, not everyone has their ups and downs, right? But the first integration was great fun. I was president of halls, so had a tiny budget to organise events, which was great fun. So very positive memories of those times, and yeah, really eye opening. I think it was exactly what we've just spoken about, going from a very set way of living and only encountering a certain kind of person, to then moving to a city like London where you meet, you know, people from all walks of life and all, you know, different opinions and different ways of living and different accents. And it really, really opens up your mind.
Because you said you never felt different growing up. Maybe this doesn't apply to you. But did you feel like suddenly coming into London with, you know, surrounded by people who are from all over the world and multiple cultures and backgrounds, did you almost feel like you fit in better in this sort of environment?
Yeah, I think I felt more accepted. I felt like it was okay to be slightly different. I was always a bit of a, I may not have felt different in terms of, you know, religion or skin color or anything, but I was always the nerd. Like, I've always been a bit of a nerd. That's just, you know, I used to feel shame identifying myself as one, but it's given me a lot of opportunity in life, so I'll take it. And I think, yeah, I always felt like a bit of a nerd. Like, I loved reading, and I didn't really know that many people that were like that, or that, you know, I felt I could connect to. Whereas in London, there's just so many different kinds of people that, I really for the first time felt, I think it might have been an internal thing. Like, I accepted myself. Like, I was starting to, you know, really say, oh yeah, yeah, it's, you know, I like who I am. Like, it's cool. And I think it's a gradual process. I think we all go through that, you know, process of just coming to terms with who we are.
That's actually so powerful, because I had that as well. At some point in university, there was a switch where it was like, okay, actually, you know what? I'm cool the way I am. And I was a nerd like you as well, which is considered uncool in school. But look at us now. We're all cool all of a sudden.
Yeah, it explains why we get along.
Okay, so moving on to finance, and obviously we're going to get into This Girl Invests. I want to start with asking you, so like, what did you study at university? Did you study a finance-related subject? And then where did you start your career?
So I actually, my thought process getting into uni, and I'm sure a lot of people have this when they're 16, was just, I kind of want to be a doctor, but I don't really want to deal with blood. So I'm going to Google what's the closest thing, and pharmacology popped up. And I was like, ooh, pharmacology, this sounds cool. And I loved it. It was really interesting. I definitely had a hiccup in the middle where I was like, oh, do I really see myself doing this or not? But it's all, I think everyone sort of goes through that when they start to think about after uni and how that's going to work. It was a fantastic degree. It's different to pharmacy in that it's more involved with how the medicine actually works in the body. So how does the medicine target, you know, whatever receptor in order to cure the illness. So very, very interesting subject, met some really nice people, but figured very quickly that I couldn't see myself working in a lab. I'm too loud, social, whatever you want to call it, to be able to do that. And another thing was, clinical trials tend to last, you know, several years, but a drug design process will last about 12 years. So you could spend an entire career trying to develop a drug, and then it goes out there in the world, and it just doesn't work because you're only, you know, you're only testing on a small sample. When you put it out there in the population, it might not really work the way you intended to. And I just found that idea really difficult. I like to, I guess it's maybe tick boxy. I like to achieve things. So not being able to, you know, say that, oh, I achieved X, Y, Z, I would have found that really difficult. So I actually started to build, I don't know if I told you this, Mitz, actually, but I started to build a business with a friend from my course. He was a great baker, and I had an egg allergy, and he could bake amazing eggless and gluten-free cakes. And this was way before the whole boom in, like, you know, gluten-free eating and vegan food and all of that. So it was right before that. So we started the brand, but I just, as we went through it, someone, you know, from the university services was like, oh, you need to start thinking about writing a business plan. And I just remember thinking, looking at this 100-page document, and I was like, I don't even know where to start. This thing is huge. There's loads of words I don't understand. And so, yeah, and we quickly had to pick whether we were going to go down the entrepreneurial route or just focus on our last year. So we ended up focusing on our last year, but that experience really cemented in my head that I wanted to go into something to do with business. And maybe that's the Cindy in me, who knows. and I met this guy through the Spanish Society who already had a job in third year, and I thought, oh well, I'll go check that out. And got an internship with Deloitte, and they basically funded my entire chartered accountancy from scratch. So it's great for anyone out there who's trying to think of, you know, making the change or Taking a different route after university, because they don't really care about what degree you do. And I found that really helpful. And it almost makes it better because you're in a group full of people who've done, different degrees, whether history, geography, economics, you name it. There was actually only two people who did accounting on my entire floor at work. So that was, and that really taught me a lot about, the business and finance side of things. And so, and I audited investment managers and private equity firms. So really, it was a big learning curve. And I think it wasn't always rainbow sunshine. There was a lot of hard work and some tough times, but it really cemented in me again that, I like what I'm doing, and I still think I can see myself doing this. And it's sort of gone from there, really. I do find finance very interesting. I think there's a lot of power in understanding it, whether it's in our personal life through personal finance or whether understanding it in a corporate environment because you're planning to build a business. So that's how I ended up in finance.
That's so interesting that you didn't study anything related to it and started off with, I don't really want to be a doctor, but I want something similar to that. A lot of people who end up in like professional services often don't have these backgrounds. I mean, I'm in Deloitte too, and I don't think anyone really studied, like, there's no such thing as studying consulting. You have different backgrounds and you learn consulting on the job and you bring, all of your skills from university. And I wouldn't say it's just the skills that you picked up in your degree. It's more the fact that you went to university and that you learned a lot in that experience. Not that, going to uni is necessary. In fact, a lot of companies now are kind of steering away from that. And I think that's so great as well. You can pick up skills from anywhere. But it's so true. Because when I was younger, I used to think what I study in uni is going to be, that's the be all and end all. I've closed every other door in my life and I'm going to do this forever. And this is at the age of 16 when you're deciding, right? And how dramatic and like unbelievable is that? We make these crazy life decisions for ourselves at that age. So few of us have actually ended up pursuing that unless you go into something which is, kind of like medicine. Yeah, we're just figuring it out, I guess. Like, I think the older I get as well, I'm kind of just like, okay, it's fine. This is not the end. There could be a big change next year. There could be a global pandemic and you never know. The whole, course of our life will change completely. Taking a step back, what was your level of understanding of finance growing up, especially as a South Asian kid? Because I know that that's a big topic that you talk about on This Girl Invests.
Yeah. My mom's a single parent. So in terms of finance, and I think also probably another thing is as a woman, even if my dad was there, he wouldn't have sat me down and started to talk to me about investing or finance or anything like it, because it's just not really, obviously every parent's different, but it's not really part of the culture. And I think so in terms of exposure to finance, it was pretty minimal. But it's only really when I came to London that I really started to get more into it and even think of it as something I could do. But then it was really when I finished my chartered accountancy and started to realize my money habits, where it was like I was earning more money, but I still didn't feel like I had more money. And I think it's called lifestyle creep, where you earn more and then you end up spending more because you think that you have more money. I found that whole notion very, very interesting. And I think that's when I really became a bit more reflective about my personal relationship with money, finances. And at the same time, I was trying to help my mum do some financial planning and really think about how she wanted to, retire and those sort of questions that really we often don't ask ourselves enough. But it really got me thinking about how I would like, my own life, my own journey to go. And so I really started to read up on it a lot. And I think there's tons of resources out there. But really to this idea of financial freedom, where there's people out there who work because they want to work and not because they need to work. And I really love that concept. I love the idea of, because then it gives you an opportunity to really work on something that you are very passionate about and that you really feel that it fulfills a purpose. because as much as we say, you know, money's important, I think there's a limit as to, you know, beyond that point, money doesn't bring that much happiness. So you need to like level up and think about the next thing. But that's really what started my own sort of interest in, you know, personal finance. This is separate to my job, because corporate finance and personal finance are sadly very different. And the financial products that are available to us as individuals is completely different to what would be available to a corporation. That's really what took it off, because I remember thinking, oh my God, there's so much jargon and I'm a chartered accountant. And almost like I felt like, how do I not know this, you know? And the more I read up, the more I realized actually, if I'm finding this difficult and I'm a chartered accountant, I can't even imagine like some of my friends who are, you know, doctors or, you know, creatives or whatever it is that just have to deal with these sort of decisions in their own life, like, and just don't have the tools and the knowledge in order to really make those informed decisions on their own. And that's what really drove me to start This Girl Invest. Well, specifically, I had to pick a niche that I wanted to stick to. I couldn't do all of finance. And the niche I went with was investing, because one of the most common thing I'd read online and forums was people regret it not starting investing early, because there's power in starting early. And it's almost like time in the market versus trying to time the market. And that really means is, it, you know, the benefit is in keeping your money invested for a long period of time versus trying to buy when the stock market's low and making money off that, because then you risk it, you know, risk losing it. So that's what sort of started the This Girl Invest journey. I thought, you know, it'd be great if I could have those conversations with my girlfriends and really get them, you know, to as just as motivated as I was to sort of try and understand and not be scared of it. It's not just men in suits and high-rise buildings who are, you know, investing. Like, you know, you and I are investors, and every one of us should be, and that is the norm. It's not just, you know, people with tons and tons of money. And I think that's the other misconception around investing, where people believe that they need a lot of money and that they just don't have enough. But that's not true. Like, you can start investing from £1 these days, which is crazy, or £25. And that's actually a luxury given to us in the UK. In Spain, it's like at least €1,000. Okay, euros. So yeah, I was trying to look into some fintech companies. Correct me if anyone's listening to this to me and knows anything better than I do, but they're just, the minimum investment is pretty high versus what there is in the UK. So it's a luxury, so may as well use it.
There's this notion that investors are usually men who, you know, wear suits and they work in finance and they know everything about investing already. And they're constantly on their phone apps, like checking the stock market or whatever. And, you know, it's with, for Indians, it's one of these things, or for South Asians, it's one of those things that I feel like uncles do. Like, uncles are known to, you know, invest in the stock market, talking about it, and like what's gone up and what's gone down. And I think because we've grown up seeing that, it's almost just like, again, it's that lack of representation. You just think, and I don't think they're very encouraging either, unfortunately, to like, let the younger people educate themselves about it, and specifically women, because it's just not something I think that's encouraged in our community at all.
No, exactly. And I think women should be doing it even more than men, and I'll explain why I say that. And so basically the way our career unfolds is completely different to a man's, right? We can't use the same financial planning principles for a man as for a woman, for really biological reasons. But we start a career, we might start at the same point, at the same, you know, salary or whatever it may be, but as the years go by, we'll tend to earn less. I mean, I'm not even going to go into that, let's just assume that's a fact for now. Women tend to earn less than men, which means that the percentage of our salary that goes into our pension pots is less. So, and statistically, women live longer than men, so more and more women are living longer than their male counterparts, but having to live with less money. So almost like living in borderline poverty, even like if there's not been a good financial plan put in place. But then on top of that, women tend to take more breaks in their careers, whether it's, you know, to take care of aging parents, because as much as we, you know, we want to you know, grow up and diversify, it, women tend to be the primary caregiver for parents, and therefore we end up taking, you know, more time off work for that, but also, of course, for our children. And that just means that there are more gaps in our career, which means that we, you know, pay less national insurance maybe sometimes, and and national insurance is what drives state pension, so whether the your country will fund you when you're retired, but then it also drives your pension pot. A solution to this, and this is only one, there's many solutions, would be to start to invest earlier and to start to make up for that gap, because then you're able to afford yourself a better growth rate over the years. So start investing, ladies.
And I think you're doing such a fantastic job of that as well, because you're making it accessible, you're making it easy to understand and less daunting. I've attended some of your webinars as well, and I think I wouldn't say I became an expert after them, but definitely I think you provide all of the tools to help at least understand what more we need to research. And often I think that's the point where I personally get stuck, is, you know, not knowing what I need to even be researching or Googling, because there's just so much jargon, like you said. And I actually wanted to share an anecdote, which was that So when I started working, really wasn't saving. And I think it was this mentality of like, I have an income now. Exactly. Yeah. You know, go to like Hakkasan whenever I want or whatever, not have any.
But I had my fun too.
Yeah. I think we all did. And it's probably necessary as well, because my parents come from this mentality of saving, and like you have to save. It's always just, you know, you make X amount, you save a certain percentage, you have to do this every month. And it would reach a point where they would almost start to be like, why aren't you saving? And for me, it was just like, yeah, but what's the point of saving like a few hundred quid a month? Like, that makes no difference to my future, kind of thing. It was this mentality, right? And and I think after like 2 or 3 years of doing that and not really thinking about my finances, I think maybe we had a conversation about this, and you were starting to get really into this whole thing of, investing and making sure you're kind of staying on top of your finances. And you taught me to automate. And I think automating has completely changed my life. I'm not joking. Like, yeah, I've probably saved more this year than I have my whole life. Like, probably thanks to COVID as well. But you know, I think that just that rule of just having money coming out without me realizing of my account just meant that I naturally reduced my spending. And so inherently I was, you know, telling myself, okay, no, I can't go to this really fancy restaurant this month. Because I've already, you know, spent quite a bit of money on this thing. So yeah, there was so much advice I got from my family of like, start, you know, making a spreadsheet. And I'd seen all sorts of things, like people had Excel spreadsheets, people would write down
budgeting, like you know, the kind that you see online. I think everyone chooses their own way of handling their finances, but
And I've tried every way, and I think I was just overwhelming myself, because at one point I had like an Excel spreadsheet, and then I had this app called Yolt, which was also like tracking my finances. And then I had just my finances being tracked in so many places. I was just like, I actually couldn't keep track.
Honestly, and I think partly also I felt like a failure. I was like, I set myself this like amazing budget. I spent so many hours setting it up. And then look, I've gone again and like bought myself this cute app that I don't need. And like there's so much guilt around it, you know? Yeah. And I think the moment I personally started to do the same, it was the same feeling. It was like, I just sat down one day and I was like, okay, so what is my income? Where's my like fixed cost that I have to go at no matter what, like my, you know, my rent, my, you know, travel, and then what are the things I'm going to allow myself to do that month. Basically it's about giving every single pound that you earn a purpose. And I think that really, because it's almost like you set yourself a goal to start with. Mm-hmm. If you don't even set yourself a goal, God knows what direction you're going to go in. Right. Whereas if you tell yourself, I'm going to do this, then you're more likely to stick to it and actually do it. It always makes me really happy to hear that I'm not alone and it's had an impact on you too.
I'm definitely a success story of this girl invest. I was going to ask you though, so just kind of following off from that, what has the response been with this platform? And
I think it's been really, really rewarding. In that, you know, the amount of messages I get from time to time that are like, you know, this is exactly what I needed. Thank you so much for doing this. It really validates the purpose of what I'm doing. And yeah, it almost says, you know, you're not alone in feeling that way, in that, you know, I felt equally as lost and equally as scared and out of my comfort zone when I first started. But yeah, I think there's two, you know, there's people that are like very on it, but there's also definitely, and just want to learn more, which is fantastic, but there's also definitely the people who are, I don't know where to start, how do I do this? So yeah, I definitely think it's filling a gap, hopefully, which is very, very nice to see.
And are there other people doing similar work, and what's that been like, being part of that community?
Oh, it's been fantastic. I think it's just really nice to, and I think you're absolutely right. I think that's something I didn't realise when I first started, that there would be an element of community building as you go through a journey. I think whenever you have an idea in your head, it's very easy to think, oh, you know, people are going to look at me and think I'm crazy, and oh, I shouldn't do it because, you know, maybe I'm not able, or whatever in a talk that you give yourself. You're always going to find an excuse. But then as you start that journey and you're like, you know what, I'm just going to put it out there in the world. And I think, Mitz, you and I were talking about this one at one point, didn't we? I think it was really you who were like, just do it. And I was like, no, but I'm scared. So as much as I helped you with automating your budget, you definitely gave me that push that I needed.
That's what friends are for.
I know. And I think as I went through that, I realized that, yeah, there is a community out there. There's tons of people who break talk about money. It's not something that's taboo. And frankly, there's a lot of people that are welcome that sort of, you know, information in their life. So, yeah, really rewarding. Some really interesting people out there doing some fantastic work as well, which is really nice to see. So I just have that out of the top of my head. There's, you know, there's Vestboard that does lots of information out there. There Frugality as well. So yeah, some great Instagrams out there as well. Some fantastic work.
Yeah, I've seen you sharing some really good content on your page as well. Just funny memes, which reminds me of like how much I need to learn still about my own finance journey. But definitely, I think it is a process. And Kiso, you mentioned being afraid of starting. How did you almost push that fear aside and get started anyway?
It was completely new to me. I actually didn't use Instagram that much. I used to delete it because I was like, yep, don't need this in my life. But for me, really, it was realizing that I had a message inside me for a very, very long time, and I remember mentioning it to you several times, and it just hitting me one day that there's people out there that are doing what we want to do, who maybe are less, you know, less qualified than us, or doing it in a different community or whatever it may be. And really, there was no reason why I had to be scared. And I think it was that realization of, you know what, just do it. Like at the end of the day, it might just not work, and at least you won't wonder. But you constantly have this repetitive thought in your head, like, just get it out of your system. And actually, initially when I did it, I didn't share it with anyone. I think you were one of the very few people that I did share it with. And I think that was obviously driven by fear and what, you know, what would people think, like the classic way of thinking. But as I grew into it, I started to care less, and I started to, to really think, you know what, this is really what I want to do, and I feel like I have a message here. And if people like it, great. And if people don't, then they don't have to look, and that's the end of it. So, I think it was a process. It was gradual, and it, you know, you have, I think it's, you know, how it's really easy to think your big goals are impossible to achieve. But when you break them down into like daily activities, so all I had to do was write one post. And I remember I even got you to like sense check that first post, like to think of that now, which just makes me laugh. But it's micro wins, right? It's like setting yourself a mini task that is going to get you one step forward towards your bigger goal. And that's really helped me across the board in many different areas of my life. Whenever I have something in my head that I want to achieve and it just feels too big that I can't even see myself achieving it, I try to break that down into what can I do today that's just going to be a tiny, weeny step forward. Like, it doesn't matter that, you know, I don't know, I'm not running a 5K, but maybe I can run a 1K or a 2K, anything, you know, in any aspect of your life. And I feel that that's really, and then as you build that confidence, it helps you overcome the fear, really.
So I'm going to give you a scenario. So I have a dream to be making six figures in the next, say, 5 years. And I also want a penthouse apartment overlooking the Thames. How the hell do I do that?
Mitz, you're already ahead of the game because A, not a lot of people actually sit down and think about what their dream goals are. And so I think the fact that you've even like said that out there in the world, that's making an impact. Because if you put it out there in the world, that makes a difference. And I think, yeah, I think there's power in putting it out there in the world, because if you put out there what you want and what you really, truly desire, and maybe this sounds a bit woo-woo and a bit like manifesting, but the right things will come to you. The right opportunities will come to you. But it starts with you putting it out there. So, yeah, I think that's one. Or even like writing it down, and having like a, you know, an accountability partner that you can be, you know, going through that journey with. Mm. Makes a really big difference. But also break it down, like you know, in order for you to make six figures, you're either going to have to, you know, up a skill, or you're going to have to build a business and become self-employed, or something you can do part-time. So start to think about how can you break that goal into, you know, some maybe big actionable pieces. And then break that down even further and say, well, if I want to upskill, I should spend this evening having a look at, you know, all the different certificates that I can get out there that might add value to my life, or, you know, get me forward in my career. And if you want a dream house, well, I think it's about, building an ecosystem around you in order for you to make that sort of money. And it is possible. It's just really, truly about believing that it can happen and setting up, as you say, the infrastructures, like automating, basically taking out the emotion out of it. And if you can do that for most of your goals in life, I think you're very likely to achieve them, because even for your biggest goals, there's going to be frustration because you're not going to be reaching that goal as quickly as you want. You know, I think that is in itself is very off-putting. You know, it's like, oh, why am I even bothering? You know, I'm not going to ever reach that goal. But that's an internal dialogue. So if you can put that to the side and say, I'm going to keep my emotions separate from this. This has nothing to do with how I'm feeling today. It's a long-term thing. And if you think of it that way, who knows, maybe you will have that dream house.
I think you touched on such an important point, which was expectations. And I think it's also what we're fed in the media, in popular culture, the fact that, you know, you can have like the most amazing mansion if you really want at the age of 25, because that's what kids do these days. And, you know, when I was graduating from university, I think I had a lot of unrealistic expectations from my life. You know, there was this idea that by the age of 25, I'm going to be doing this. And by 20, you know, 28, 29, I'm going to be here and I'm going to be in like this position. And I'm, you know, now very close to my late 20s. I'm basically in them. And I think what you learn to do is learn to manage your own expectations. But often what happens is it comes with a lot of resentment towards life and towards yourself, because I think so much of that process of unlearning that has been full of disappointment for me.
I think mindset is half the game, right? If you tell yourself, I can't do this, or this is too difficult, or this is such a big goal that I won't achieve it, then yeah, you're probably right. You know, you're not going to achieve it. Mm. Whereas if you work on your mindset and you, I think there's also power in routine. It's like, you know, how do you optimize your day in order to make sure that the things that you're doing day to day are aligning to your larger goals? Mm. Because it's never glamorous, you know, as much as, you know, having an Instagram page sounds great fun, half the time it's really hard work, you know, having to come up with content, having to be engaging, having to, like one single definition takes me ages because I have to reread it and say, okay, is this making sense? Mm. So it comes with hard work, and I'm sure everyone else can say the same for all their individual goals and the things that they've achieved. It's not always glamour, you know, it's not always glamorous. And I think it's the people who don't work for money and do it for something bigger that end up achieving a lot in their life. And I think that's when you're getting your first job, it seems like it's all about the money, right? That all you want to do is get a good job and earn loads of money, because then it's going to give you social status and like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? But then the people that do earn loads of money don't handle it properly because they're, you know, they're like, oh, I work so hard, so therefore I'm going to spend it all. And then they're left with not a lot at the end. Mm. So really the people who, you know, the billionaires and the millionaires of this world have a very strong purpose. Like what makes Jeff Bezos wake up every day and still work his ass off? You know, there must be something more than money. And I think that is what inspires me. If I can get to a point in my life where it just is no longer about the money, I am just so driven by my purpose, then I feel like I will have made it in life.
Amen. I think that's so important because, yeah, I agree. If you're chasing money, there will be a point where it no longer makes you happy. There's so many studies about how, you know, happiness is not in proportion with the amount of money after a certain point. So I think that's really important. But unfortunately, we live in a world where we're fed, you know, all these things about how more money is going to make you happier and more things are going to make you happier. And looking a certain way is going to make you happier. And it's literally, I feel like it's just a very deliberate lie to kind of all brainwash everyone just so they're focusing on the wrong things, because God forbid we start focusing on things like climate change and stuff that actually makes the world a better place and makes, you know, the big corporations lose money. So definitely I agree with that. So obviously This Girl Invests, I assume you're running it on the side at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you ever have plans on taking it full time, or do you ever see yourself in the long-term future?
I wouldn't rule out being self-employed, but I think I'd have to be in a very secure position in order to ever make that sort of leap. I think it's personal preference. I think if you're able to feel secure regardless of not having a full-time job, then, you know, kudos to you. But personally, I don't see myself taking this full-time anytime soon. But who knows? Never say never.
Yeah. How do you manage yourself running such a big platform now and, you know, full-time job and everything?
I think it's about assigning myself individual tasks every evening. So every evening I'll say, well, today I'll send out an email, or today I'll, you know, I'll do X, Y, Z. But also really batching. I think I've been reading up on that, and there's a lot of power in, you know, doing a repetitive task at once, and then you don't have to constantly rewire your brain in order to redo that task again. So yeah, that's been really powerful, and it's really helped me reconsider maybe some other aspects of my life and how I can apply that there too. But most of it is really not having too high expectations for myself. You know, like at the end of the day, I have a day job, I am tired in the evening as well, so let me just assign myself something that's realistic, because it's better to do something small than nothing at all, because it just feels so big, I'm overwhelmed. So yeah, I think that's the way of I try and approach it. It's never a clear cut, you know, method. I think it just depends. Some days I'm caught up with something else, but I try to stick by it where I can.
That's so interesting, because I'm very different in that way. I think for me, it's accountability when it comes to other people. So when I'm recording the podcast, I know that, you know, someone's expecting me to be ready to record. And so that motivates me. And I think I'm very deadline driven as well. So if, for example, if I have an illustration, you know, deadline, like a commission for a client, I take so much pride in my clients when it comes to, you know, just personal work, because I mean, obviously in the full-time job, it's different because you're working on a bigger scale. They're seeing you as a company rather than a human being. And you see them as a company as well. Whereas when you're working kind of on that lower scale, with just one client, you see how happy things make them. And, you know, you see how much they value that. And I think, like, when it comes to trying to just make sure, you know, I'm providing a good customer service, for example, I think that's what drives me. So rather than having a list, I'll be working till 2 a.m. if I have to get something done, because I know I promised my client I'm going to give it in tomorrow.
I definitely have a part of that too. There's definitely times where I've had something on my list for days, haven't done it for whatever reason. Maybe I'm scared, maybe it feels too big or whatever it is. And I'll say it out there in the world. So I'll say on Instagram, oh, tomorrow I'm doing a video. And then I just have to. Like, so it's like, oh, I've said I'm going to do a video, so therefore I must make sure that I do a video. So, I think when I find myself in that procrastination mode, for whatever reason, it's probably internal beliefs or whatever it is, I make sure that I say it out there in the world, and therefore it now is a thing.
That's so profound, and actually it's such a good way, because all of a sudden people are waiting for you to do it, so it's kind of embarrassing if you don't. Also, in terms of multiple streams of income, is that something that you recommend everybody have if they want to achieve their financial goals?
Yeah, great question. Oh, look at you quoting multiple streams of income. I love it. So what's the idea behind multiple streams of income? Really, the idea is all of us go to work each day and we expect to be rewarded with salary at the end of the month. And therefore, we are relying on that company being there tomorrow. We are relying on our jobs being there tomorrow. And we're relying on still being employed by this company tomorrow. And really, that puts a lot of risk in one place. It's almost like all your eggs are in one basket. Like, you're, if tomorrow, you know, something happens, you are in a position of, yeah, borderline poverty, because you just don't have anything else to fall back on. I mean, if you've got a good financial plan, you've got an emergency fund in place, and therefore it's not the end of the world, you'll survive a couple of months. But really, beyond that, it's like you better find a job quickly, right? And I think everyone constantly lives in this fear of you know, losing their job, or especially in times like this, it can be quite triggering. The idea of multiple streams of income is setting yourself up in a way where you have money coming in from many places, and therefore, ideally, if tomorrow your job did go, you'd be able to recover quickly, or quicker than someone else who purely relied on that income. And examples of alternative incomes that you can have, it can be, you know, a side hustle income, it can be a dividend income from some shares that you hold, it can be interest income because you've got a bond. It really varies, and I think sometimes it's really easy to believe that, you know, we wear one hat and one hat only, and we are expected to be that way at work. But in our generation especially, I think more people are starting to capitalize on their skill sets. You know, the online world is an amazing place, and there's a lot to show for it. So yeah, that's the idea of multiple streams of income. And I personally, I think there's a lot of power in that. Mm. I think it gives you a sense of security, because at the end of the day, you know, money is just money, right? You know, but we attach emotion to it, right? We attach, oh, money will buy me my dream house. Money will buy me my, you know, that great dress that I saw. Money will buy me X, Y, Z, whatever it is. So really, when we're talking about money, we're not talking about money itself, right? We're talking about our goals and dreams. And it's just so much more profound than just the money. Mm. And security is a very important aspect of that. You know, we often put ourselves in positions of financial risk, like we don't plan for a bad day. And really we should. So I think that's one way of insuring yourself against losing your job, really.
That's so useful to know, because again, it's not something that's really widely spoken about. Maybe more so now, yes, but you know, growing up it wasn't a thing. It was always you have one job, you focus on it, you do your best, yeah, and that's it. But what happens if, you know, COVID happens and then you lose your job? There's so many layers to that. And I think that's why the work that you do is so important, because it's important to actually understand the risks as well of not doing it.
Yeah.
I've definitely had to really think about it after some really poor financial choices in my life. I think there's been so much useful information we've picked up today. So thank you for sharing that. What hopes do you have for This Girl Invests? Like, what longer term goals do you have?
I'd love this to be a community. I'd love this to be a place that people think, you know, and maybe this is big and bold and saying it out loud sounds a bit crazy, but I'd love for, say, when you and I have our own kids and we think, you know, how am I going to have the conversation of money with my child, you know, that This Girl Invest pops up as a potential way of educating our daughters and future generations on really, you know, how to make learning about money fun and easy, and it doesn't feel something big and daunting that you have to think about all of a sudden in your 20s. It's almost like a journey of you know, that they start hopefully earlier in their lives.
I guess, would you want to go more global with it as well?
I'd love to. Yeah, why not? You know, just why not? Like, let's see where it goes. I'm very open to see where it goes. But yeah, for now, I'm just loving every piece of the journey and every single thank you and every single, you know, I got insurance, or I finally met my emergency fund, or I finally understand my budget. Like, any little bit that I can do to make someone else's journey easier, because I remember how difficult it was to start, you know, to do that completely from scratch. And and I hope I'm making someone's life easier.
You are, and you're making such a positive impact. And I'm so proud of you as well, because I think also coming from a very similar Spanish Sindhi background, it's so nice to see, you know, someone who's had such a almost similar upbringing, also kind of pursuing her dreams. And yeah, I love seeing that, like knowing people from so far back, like from when we were teenagers, to now seeing you making such a difference, I think is so wonderful to watch. Final question for you, Prerna, is what do you have strong game in, and what could you have stronger game in?
Awesome. I love this. I love this question. Okay. So what do I have strong game in? I'd say it's my optimism. There's power in there, in truly believing that anything is possible. So I guess I'm a believer. I don't know, all my dreams will come true, but for now I still believe they will. So that's my strong game. And to your second question, what could I have strong game in? I'd probably say focus. I think in this generation it's a difficulty when you have, you know, your mobile phone right next to you, a laptop, like constant access to all the information in the world, to not sort of end up in the hole that is the internet. So I think that's probably something that I could have strong game in, better focus.
I think so many of us have that issue, and there's some really good books around that as well, actually, on how to focus better. I've just bought one called Deep Work, so I haven't read it yet, but I'll let you know.
Yeah,
how that is. But just like knowing how to go into that flow state when you're working, especially for those of us who are so busy all the time and jumping between full-time work and side hustles, I think it's so important to know when to, like, you know, really get your head down. I found what works for me, by the way, is Pomodoro technique. I'm sure a lot of people have spoken about it on other podcasts, but essentially what it is so Pomodoro is obviously a tomato. I think that's the idea around it, is it's a tomato timer. So essentially it's like how you would set a timer for when you're cooking. You basically set this, you set this timer. You can get it as a plugin in Chrome, and it basically runs for 25 minutes, where you have to basically focus and not use any apps. And it also has the functionality to turn off your app. So if you try and go on them, it basically shouts at you.
Yeah.
And then you get a 5-minute break after that, where you can get up, stretch your legs, check Instagram, do whatever you want, and then go back into 25 minutes. So it's like 25 minute states of flow. And I used it in university to study, and it was really effective. So I would recommend that for you.
I love that. And I think it's becoming rarer and rarer that I get into that flow state. But yeah, I love that idea. I'll check that out.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much once again for coming on the podcast. It's been really fun speaking with you, even though we had a little bit of a scare where we thought we lost our file, but all good.
Technology. No, thank you, Miss. I think what you're doing is amazing, and I look forward to listening to the other episodes as well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. Take care. I'll speak to you soon.
Speak soon. Bye.
Bye.